Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Okay, this is episode 268. This week we've got something really special. We have a Halloween themed episode. I don't think we've ever done one of these before, so we've got some great stuff on here, some Masonic ghost stories. We've got a great segment by illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison. But first, I just want to take a minute to remind all of you about Masonic Revival. This episode and so many more are brought to you by Masonic Revival, where you can get contemporary designs for the modern day Freemason. This is a Masonic design group that inspires elegance for the modern day Freemason, and they've been around since 2009. The line includes aprons, neckties, pocket squares, tie bars, other accessories, even recently a really, really nice classy watch. One of the things that's great is they really look at the global style. So the global reach that Freemasonry has, we're all over the place. So wouldn't it be important to pay attention to those global style and fabric trends? And I think so. Masonic Revival does that. Brother Edgar Alejandro, a past master, is the proprietor of Masonic Revival, and he does a great job. So please go over to MasonicRevival.com, check out his new arrivals, which again include the Regal Masonic Watch. He's got a great new forget-me-not tie in a bunch of colors, like a blue, light blue, red, and black. There's a new red necktie. It's called the Royal. It comes in a bow tie as well. Pocket squares. He's got the new sprig of Acacia Antique silver pin. And one of my favorites, the Azul Paisley necktie, which also comes in a bow tie. Just a number of wonderful items. So head on over there to check that out. And thanks very much to Masonic Revival, the sponsor for this episode. So let's get right into this week's topic, Haunted Masonry. I found this article on The Hedge Mason, The Ghosts of Freemasonry, Haunted Lodges. As with many other aspects of life, the belief in spirits, and by extension, ghostly haunting, is subjective and highly personal. Two common popular responses attempt to establish the idea of spirit contact as either frivolous idea suitable for entertainment or gullible naivete. For most, the search for understanding ceases there. For many who have been habituated to skepticism or disbelief, it's nonsense. For many who do believe, it's a matter of faith alone. There is another group, of course, who straddle the world of the organic or natural view of the world and the materialism that has so infested Cartesian science. As trained folklorist, PhD, University of Pennsylvania, 2005, who spent a large part of my graduate career examining belief studies, I learned early on that despite the public discourse which attempts to dismiss belief in discarnate intelligence as a superstition and part of our past as a species, even in the United States, according to various polls, more than half of the population believes in life after death. And a significant minority, nearly half, believe that ghosts or spirits can have contact with the living. Many also maintain that they, or members of their families, or friends, have had such contact. Wherever you may stand on the issue, in the absence of measurable proof, science, according to its own precepts, cannot offer an opinion on the matter. This is despite the claims made by materialists with axes to grind on the subject. Lack of evidence does not equate to a determination that something does not exist. It merely indicates that science has not been able to provide evidence. Further, despite science's presumption that all things will eventually be uncovered or measured, there's no proof to support that belief. None of that is a claim that ghosts or spirits do exist, or we can have contact with them. Vast amounts of anecdotal accounts exist, and you can collect many from your own friends and relatives when you approach the matter in the way that puts them at ease. People who tend to deny having certain beliefs or experiences when they feel they may be subject to ridicule are often quite forthcoming when they feel they have a sympathetic ear. I cannot state to a materialist scientist's satisfaction that spiritual entities exist, and I am not interested in convincing other individuals to believe any particular perspective. This is one of those things we need to decide for ourselves, and if we are intelligent or perhaps rather confident, we will not need to try to change other people's minds. The only reason anyone tries to convert another, whether in religion or in opinion, is due to insecurity. What I will note is that those who believe in the reality of spiritual entities or ghosts often do so as a result of the rational conclusions they draw from other beliefs they hold. But those who are certain of their existence do so as a result of personal experiences, either their own or those of people whose judgments they trust. More often, it's from personal experience. There's an amazing amount of personal experience out there, as anyone who has studied the subject can attest. All of this rambling commentary serves as an introduction to a fascinating subject, the haunting of Masonic lodges. You may approach this as a fascinating peek at paranormal science, or as a piece of entertaining fluff. If you enjoy the entry, I frankly don't mind which view you entertain. For a long time, it was taboo among academics and the social sciences to admit that they accepted spiritual realities as, well, reality. With the discussion of personal metaphysical experience in the course of cultural research by no less a figure in anthropology than Edith Turner, and the subsequent founding of the Anthropology of Experience, this should no longer be an issue. Scholars have written about their personal experiences of phenomena such as possession without putting their credentials at risk. I am no exception. However, it remains until such time as the obsessive Cartesians can figure out how to materially quantify an essentially immaterial phenomenon. They never stop trying except when they want to deny it's possible. A matter of personal belief. I leave that to each of you to decide. In the meantime, I wish to offer a sampling of reports in the media and online concerning haunted Masonic lodges. This is by no means a scientific study. I have done no academic study of the subject, nor should my mention of any one of these stories or sites be taken to infer a viewpoint about their authenticity, nor approval of whatever techniques or approach used by any individual in any of these cases. In fact, the majority of references we find online after weeding out announcements of Masonic haunted houses being organized for Halloween fall into three general categories. The first, reports concerning hauntings, including in the majority variations of traditional ghost stories. The second category is one which is on the rise. These consist of reports relating to ghost hunters who purport to use electronic equipment and recording devices, sound, video, and still cameras to document and quote-unquote prove hauntings. These have mushroomed after the genre became popular on cable television. The third, and by far the least common, are performances of or in haunted Masonic lodges. Some are dramatic, some are staged by entertainers and stage magicians. It would appear that haunted Masonic lodge is itself something of a trope, a literary rhetorical device or figurative scheme of thought which may be constitutive of our experience. The idea of a haunted Masonic lodge seems to be a coming together of a number of standardly held stereotypes. Masons are mysterious and secretive. Masons delve into the metaphysical. Masons are dangerous, and of course, large old buildings, especially deserted ones, are subject to hauntings. So, as you might have expected, or been hoping, if you've read this far, you will now be treated to some brief reports of ghostly encounters in haunted Masonic lodges. We start with Boston's abandoned Masonic Hall. Of this site, we find that the old temple was recently bought by photographer Liam Carlton, 36, who told the UK's Daily Mail that, quote, "We've heard things and seen a few things. There have been a few cases of footsteps running around the building. There's also been a female form show up in the hallway. That's only happened twice in the time I've been here, and on both occasions it was during a sunset." Mr. Carlton, who is currently renovating the building, has been told he should try and do something about the hauntings, although he doesn't agree. "If it isn't trying to hurt me," he said, "I won't mess with it. I'll just let it be." The old Davenport Lodge, number 37, in Davenport, Iowa, was donated in 1996 to Palmer College. It now houses a museum and lecture halls. Many types of haunting phenomena at all hours of the day have been reported by the college security staff. These involve moving objects, items winding up in odd places, furniture rearrangement, footsteps, weird moving lights, the aroma of cigars, cold spots, cool breezes not coming from the air conditioning or natural wind source, odd noises, disembodied voices in discussion, or the calling out of names, individuals being touched by an unseen presence, having the feeling of being watched, and the actual visual sightings of apparitions. It is claimed that security cameras have provided clear evidence of an entity or entities unknown still enjoying their good times as Masons. It appears that Detroit's awesome Masonic temple, said to be the largest in the world, is haunted by more than economic woes. Built in 1912, George D. Mason, the Detroit Masonic Temple has over 1,000 rooms, several secret staircases, concealed passages, and hidden compartments and floors. Brother Mason went slightly overboard when financing the construction of the building, and eventually went bankrupt, resulting in his wife leaving him. Overwhelmingly depressed about his financial and personal circumstances, Mason jumped to his death from the roof of the temple. Security guards claim to see his ghost to this day, ascending the steps to the roof. The temple, abundant with cold spots, inexplicable shadows, and slamming doors, is known to intimidate visitors with the eerie feeling of being watched. The financial woes associated with this building have remained with it and continue to haunt the Masons of Detroit, much like the man who built it does. Over the years, lodge members and visitors alike have reported many strange ghostly happenings at the Morrison Lodge in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, including apparitions of what appear to be Civil War era soldiers, door alarms that ring even when no one leaves or enters the building, phantom footsteps, objects that move around on their own, strange knocking sounds, ghostly figures, and even helpful ghosts, possibly former lodge members, who once saved a lodge member from unconsciousness when he fell ill and passed out while alone in the building. Past investigations in the building have collected photos, EVPs, and first-hand accounts of the hauntings. The Masons in Elizabethtown, at least from time to time, offer ghostly tours as well. And lastly, I have no details on the purported ghostly activity at this lodge. We have to make mention of this lodge in Indianapolis area. The reason? It's named Irvington Lodge, number 666. Alright, so what's cool about that is the beginning of that piece gives you a really good, firm footing right here on Earth before we dive into that supernatural. So I hope you enjoyed that first piece, which talks about just a few little blurbs. Now, we're going to go into a couple more Masonic ghost stories that are more specific to a location, a lodge, or perhaps an individual. So the next one we're going to go into is a Seattle Masonic ghost story, and we'll go into that right now. A Seattle Masonic ghost story. Reader, you decide. Submitted for your consideration, Rod Serling, creator of the Twilight Zone and Night Gallery. As any electrician can tell you, when a circuit is closed, the current flows. Switch a light on, and you close a circuit, making electrical current flow and power on a light bulb. Switch it off, and you open the circuit, breaking the flow of electricity. The following story is true insofar as the events it relates really did occur. All of the witnesses are young and healthy, two of them are in the 20s and the oldest is 55. Two of them hold PhDs and like much of Seattle's population, two of them are high-tech experts and who understand circuitry quite well. You get the idea. We all have given due consideration to the event we witnessed, yet remain open-minded to the reasonable skepticism. You, our reader, may or may not agree with our interpretation, but if you do, mere skepticism is insufficient to justify dismissing the testimony of the eyewitnesses out of hand. By way of introduction, just as you must believe that Jacob Marley was dead in order to appreciate Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, you must understand this basic fact about electricity in order to approach what five witnesses regard as a possible instance of paranormal activity at 1608 4th Avenue West, the location of Queen Anne Masonic Lodge, founded in 1921. The witnesses' story emerged as much from the facts about the event we are about to relate as it depends upon the value and relevance of such biographical information as remains about our charter members. Queen Anne Masonic Lodge, number 242, was chartered in the twilight years of the Edwardian era, between the two Great Wars and before the Great Depression, when Seattle was still riding the wave of prosperity of the Alaskan Gold Rush and was more important and prosperous than Los Angeles. One of the charter members of Queen Anne Masonic Lodge No. 242 was Brother George R. Milstead, who met with the other charter members in the Queen Anne branch of the Seattle Public Library in the year 1921 to draft our bylaws and begin the process of forming the lodge. Our charter was granted in June of 1921 amid much public ceremony recorded in the Queen Anne News. Judging from the photograph, Brother George R. Milstead had appeared to be a robust, bald young man with calm yet penetrating blue eyes. He would be the first junior warden, but no one could have known that he would not live to serve his term as worshipful master when his photograph as worshipful master was taken. Brother George R. Milstead passed away before his installation. He would live only long enough to be pleased at his election and to have a photograph taken in September of 1923 to report that he was about to fill that distinguished and honored office for the 1923-1924 year. Thus, for the previous year, in sure anticipation of assuming the chair of honor in the East, Brother Milstead had served as our senior warden. As all Masons know, this is a position whose chair is in the west of the lodge room. In the case of Queen Anne Masonic Lodge, this also is the place in which the lighting for the entire room is controlled from a console at the senior warden's podium. Now, our story, or perhaps Brother Milstead's own, can be told. If it is Brother Milstead's story, may it give him rest. You decide. On the night of Wednesday, February 16th, 2011, AL 6011, five Master Masons, including the current Worshipful Master in his second term in the East, another twice past Master, and three other Master Masons were in the lodge room rehearsing Masonic ritual in preparation for the following night, when another worthy man would be initiated in our mysteries. During this rehearsal, an odd event occurred, yet not without some precedent, as you'll soon discover. A sixth Master Mason was downstairs and did not witness the event. His role also is a significant one, as you'll appreciate presently. At one particularly challenging point in the rehearsal, while all five of the Master Masons present in the lodge room were standing at least 5 paces from the station of the senior warden in the west, from which all the lights in the lodge room are controlled, the current Worshipful Master finished a line, and all the lights in the lodge room were extinguished immediately after the Worshipful Master's line, so that it seemed as though the outage had occurred on cue. The elder past master ran to the door of the lodge room and bounded down the stairs to ask the sixth Master Mason, an expert building maintenance man, to investigate the source of the outage. He was in the kitchen on the phone with his young son at the time of the incident and throughout most of the aftermath. This brother had been far from the fuse box during the event and well away from the instrument, which our past master had gone down to inspect. Hearing this, the past master went back upstairs only to find the lights back on. But how? The current Worshipful Master informed the returning twice past master, with all present as witnesses, that after he had run downstairs, the Worshipful Master had, to prevent himself from stumbling on the steps at the senior warden's station, inched his own way through near darkness to the lighting console. Mysteriously, when his hands were still inches from the console, and before he could so much as touch the switch, and without any other brother upstairs or downstairs near any electrical controls, the lights suddenly came back on. Still more mysteriously, once the lights had come back on, he could see that the switch had been in the on position the whole time. An inexplicable contradiction of how electric circuitry works. The rehearsal resumed uneventfully, and culminated in an excellent initiation the following night. Nothing like this has ever happened at 1608 4th Avenue West, to our knowledge. As for precedent, various socially unrelated individuals, Masons and non-Masons alike, none of whom knew Brother Milstead, have reported to the twice-past master that when they stood near at or near Brother Milstead's last station in the lodge, his station in the west as senior warden, they felt an odd chill within a certain radius of that station. These individuals revealed their impressions in an off-the-cuff manner, independently and without prompting. They all reported the sensation that they were being watched or watched over. The most severe critics of Freemasonry, who also believe in a personal post-mortem consciousness existence, and who would seriously entertain the idea that Brother Milstead was present, will undoubtedly be inclined to suggest that our deceased Brother Milstead, or some other spiritual entity righteous in their eyes, had been manifesting his disapproval of Freemasonry by shutting out the Masonic light during our rehearsal. Yet the following night, no such disapproving interruption took place. On the contrary, it was a night of ritual virtually devoid of errors and well performed by all. It would appear that if it was our Brother Milstead who disrupted affairs the night before, he did so to manifest his role as a member of a very special category of sideliners to the degree one. We welcome, nay, we would solicit Brother Milstead's continued assistance and invite our readers to decide whether what happened was an inexplicable event in electrical circuitry, or an unverifiable visit, as the late Rod Serling would have concluded, from the Twilight Zone. Alright, and with that, we are going to go into this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison.
I figured I'd better get upstairs. I didn't want to go to the seance. Yes, the seance. And after that, the top 3 floors would be closed. Forever. I'd worked in the building 3 years and never been up there. This was my last chance. With no working elevators, I hoofed it up the stairs and emerged in the dark, fourth-floor hallway of the doomed building. My eyes adjusted and I slowly made my way to the rooms in the northwest corner. I opened the door and entered the fabled room. There were no drapes covering the windows, and the bright light nearly blinded me. The room was stark and dirty. To my left was a broken wheelchair. A sink jutted out from the wall. Its basin was stained and dusty. Beneath it was a wastebasket, full. A bed frame with an old mattress was over by the window. All told, the room was disappointing. It just didn't seem, well, as auspicious as it should, given what had happened there many, many years ago on Halloween. Halloween and Freemasonry. There are probably many tie-ins, what with all the costumes worn in degree work, skulls, and other symbols, and that's before the conspiracy theorists weigh in. Occasionally, though, the pairing of the mysterious holiday and Freemasonry brings to mind images of Harry Houdini, a life member of St. Cecile Lodge 568 in New York City. A man of mystery, you could almost say Brother Harry lived Halloween 24/7. Aside from being arguably the world's greatest magician and escape artist, Houdini maintained an abiding interest in the paranormal. He did not, however, deceitfully promote it as he felt many did. He despised fraudulent seers and mediums and worked tirelessly to expose their chicanery, saying whatever was left that he couldn't expose must be real. He made many attempts to communicate with his mother after she died, but found no evidence of contact. Still, feeling communication with the other side was possible, he made a pact with his wife, Bessie, that the first to die would attempt to contact the other through a coded message. No one knows what the full message was, but part of the pact was that Houdini would open a pair of silver handcuffs they owned. Bessie never received any communication from Houdini after his death, but hundreds of psychics claimed they did. During his life, the great Houdini did everything he could to separate the fake aspects of spiritualism from what he thought might be real. He testified before Congress against spiritualists and fortune tellers, and so adamant was he that they were charlatans. The hearing broke out in a shouting match, and some of the spectators tried to attack Houdini. On October 26, 1926, Houdini received a painful blow to the stomach in a demonstration at McGill University in Montreal. Contrary to popular opinion, most medical experts believe the blow was unrelated to the appendicitis attack that followed. However, Houdini failed to get treatment, thinking the pain in his stomach was due to the punch to his abdomen. After his appearance in Montreal, he traveled to Detroit, where he collapsed at the end of a performance. 5 days later, on Halloween, Harry Houdini died. I was standing in a nondescript empty room on the fourth floor of Old Grace Hospital in Detroit. The building, once considered progressive and modern, had deteriorated to the point it would be torn down in a few months. I ran the IT department downstairs, and once my group moved out, the wrecking ball would move in. I soaked it all in. Somehow, it just didn't seem that special. But shortly, several people in the news media, this year including Time magazine, would gather there as they had done for years on Halloween. This wasn't just any room. This was the very place where, on October 31st, 1926, Brother Harry Houdini died. I took a final look and turned to leave. As I walked away, people filed past me to enter the room for Houdini's last séance. Houdini, as had been the case on every Halloween in Grace Hospital since he died, did not show up. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
Always appreciated, Brother Steve Harrison bringing us some amazing segments. I always love things about Houdini, find the man fascinating and just so cool. So again, thanks to Brother Steve Harrison. If you are so inclined, please head on over to Amazon.com and search for his books, or you can just click on the WCY bookstore where there are links to everything right there. So at this time, before we have our last couple pieces about Masonic hauntings, I would like to remind you all how this show happens. This show happens because you guys are the producers. You produce this show by your continued support and purchasing our lapel pins, which are available at wcypodcast.com. Click on Buy a Pin. There's a full explanation of the pin. Its esoteric and exoteric symbolism is all explained there for you. Pin is very high quality. So if you click Support the Show on wcypodcast.com, there are a few great links to some really cool products. We are still the sole place you can get King Solomon's Reserve, an exclusive collaboration with our podcast from Banker's Best. It is the original beard oil recipe with a fragrance specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location. So black fig and honey give the tried and trusted oil formula a rich and luxurious scent that is truly fit for our first Grand Master. It is a wonderful product. People love it. So check it out there. Click on Support the Show and the link is there. It's the only place you can get it. You can't go to buybankersbest.com and find it. If you do go to buybankersbest.com, please make sure to check out some of their amazing products that they have: beard balms, oils, and lip balm. If you use the promo code BBWCY357, you'll get 20% off, and Brother Levi sends a little bit back to this program to help out. You can also go over to freemasonryart.com, where you can find some great Masonic art done by Brother Juan Sepulveda, all the art made here in the USA by Brother, unique products which are unavailable anywhere else. Professional fine art, amazing quality, and he also offers real lambskin aprons, which he can do art on, so you're wearing a piece of original artwork. It's not printed, it's an original piece of artwork, so keep that in mind when you check those aprons out. Of course, we have our Alpha Brain and Hemp Force Protein from Onnit Labs, which is a sponsor of the show. So if you go to wcypodcast.com, click on that Support the Show, and click through the links. If you click through the links, that's how they know you heard about it from us. So you can get any number of cool products there. Again, use the promo code WCY just about anywhere I mention, and you'll get at least 10% off. And again, mentioning our show sponsor this week, MasonicRevival.com, where you can buy pretty much the hippest Masonic regalia and neckties and accoutrements that you can find anywhere. Edgar Alejandro designs them, does the work, and they're all amazing. So please do consider going over to MasonicRevival.com. This isn't just a square and compass thrown up on anything and making it very generic looking. This is, I would almost call it purpose driven. It's really cool. And last but not least, you can just donate via PayPal. If you not want to do any shopping or you don't need anything, consider just going over to the website and clicking donate via PayPal and send us 50 cents, send a dollar. Whatever you can do is always appreciated, and all the money goes right back into this program, and it brings you all the episodes forever. We don't have to offer a backlog for an extra cost or anything. Everything's always available all the time for you guys and for everybody to listen to, and hopefully bring members into the fraternity, satisfy the educational needs of men in the fraternity already, and entertain. So I hope you guys like it. Thanks again for listening to this show and for all the support you've given. It is absolutely humbling that we have the kind of supporters we have. So thank you once again. All right, now, this comes from hauntedhouses.com. This is a rundown of Masonic buildings that are reported to have been haunted or are haunted. We'll give the description, the address, location, and description history kind of thing, and you decide, right? Maybe you want to go there and check it out. First up, haunted place, the old Masonic Temple Building, Lyceum Hall, and Museum owned by Palmer College. We just mentioned that. The address is 7th and Brady Street in Davenport, Iowa. Location, the old Davenport Lodge No. 37 building, now known as Lyceum Hall and Museum, can be found on 7th Street and Brady Street. Description, history. This immense, bland-looking yet impressive building with Greek touches does indeed make a great spot for a museum, where Palmer College can put on display on various floors their students and faculties' accomplishments and the study of chiropractic itself, helping to promote Palmer College of Chiropractic to visitors and other interested parties. This four-story gray cement block building was constructed in 1922 when Masons in Davenport realized they needed a new building. This new Masonic temple opened its doors on November 19, 1923 and was dedicated as Davenport Lodge No. 37, a lodge of Master Masons with 400 members, many of whom were policemen. In 1996, the Masonic Temple was sold to Palmer College because of the high cost of upkeep and other circumstances. The sale made sense, as Palmer College boundaries had grown southward, 7th Street being its new southern border. This old temple building is just across the street from Pi Kappa Chi and the Palmer Center for Chiropractic Research, which is a strategic spot for a museum and perhaps a fancy event location or lecture hall. The history of manifestations. Groups of men found in various traditional organizations for men, military, police, gangsters, masons, etc., have experienced male bonding on an intense level, which creates a loyalty and commitment that can even outlast a lifespan. Some individuals can't let go of this world because of their loyalty, sense of duty, and the bonding with others, which they grew to depend on for a satisfaction that would be hard to replace. Manifestations. All the paranormal activity which takes place in this building has been boiled down to one sentence by other websites. Many types of haunting phenomenon at all hours of the day, end quote, have been reported by the college's security staff. What does this statement mean? It means that the living are treated to the full menu of paranormal experience both day and night, probably caught on the building security system if not directly experienced by the staff or visitors to the museum. Paranormal occurrences which could be experienced. Moving objects. Items winding up in odd places, furniture rearrangement, footsteps, weird moving lights, aroma of cigars, cold spots, cold breezes, not coming from the air conditioner, or natural wind sources. Odd noises, disembodied voices in discussion, or the calling out of names. Being touched by an unseen presence, having the feeling of being watched, and actual visual sightings of apparitions. Still haunted? Yes, indeed. Security cameras offer clear evidence of an entity or entities unknown still enjoying their good times as Masons. So that article just comes from hauntedhouses.com and of course was mentioned in a previous article as well. So I just want to mention that upon further research, we need to go back to that Detroit Masonic Temple piece, and we should say that George Mason did not leap to his death from the roof of the Masonic building, but instead died in bed at the age of 92 in 1948. So that's it. Lots of people say that Waukegan Lodge 78 is haunted. I don't know. I've never experienced anything at my own lodge. I did use an EVP analysis app on my phone once. I don't know how accurate those are. But there were some interesting things that popped up as far as words. I may have to actually do an investigation at some point. If we do, I'll have to let you guys all know how it comes out. But that's it for this week. So I really hope you enjoyed this quote-unquote Halloween episode, haunted masonry, as it were. There was a great, if you really kind of like these fun episodes like this, Brother Juan Sepulveda did an amazing job, I believe, last year for a Halloween episode about a hotel that was haunted, and it was a really great episode. It had a great feel to it, so check that out if you get a minute. Speaking of other outlets, if you do like Masonic podcasts, please do not forget to check out the Masonic Roundtable, which goes live every Tuesday at 10/9 Central. It's a great program. We've got five Masons. A lot of times we have guests. We talk about all kind of amazing and great things related to Freemasonry. We don't stray away from difficult topics, which is proven difficult, but we always face those conversations head on. And what's great is we can interact with you live during the show. So you can be a part of the episodes just by tweeting us or writing some comments on the Facebook page, because we will cover social media and answer your questions right there during the episode live. So it's very fun. I would also like to mention that I will be at University Lodge in Austin, Texas at the Austin Club in January. We're having a date change. I believe it's going to be 1 week later, so around the 26th. I believe, in January. The presentation there will focus on the lost word, the Tetragrammaton, as well as some history on the idea of the word. And then we'll also be presenting in Boston, Massachusetts area, up at Ezekiel Bates Lodge at Masonicon 2017 in April. So both of those events are booked. I'm going. Tickets are bought. I'll see you guys there. And so that's it, guys. Till next week, I hope you have an amazing Halloween. Stay safe. Have fun and stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.